within the trails we ride.
You're listening to the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick is a horseman, trainer, international clinician, and author who helps empower horse people from all over the world with the skills, knowledge, and mindsets needed to create trusting partnerships with their horses. Warwick offers a free 7-day trial to his comprehensive online video library that includes hundreds of full-length training videos and several home study courses at videos.warwickschiller.com. Just because you see
what it shows. G'day everyone, welcome back to the Journey On podcast. I'm your host Warwick Schiller, and this week I have a special guest by the name of Kim Keziah Sherrod. Kim is from Montana, and she's the creator and director of the School of Applied Integrative Therapy, which is for teaching people how to work on horses. But Kim, there's a whole lot more to it than that. Like all our podcast guests, there's quite a journey that got to doing that. And I'm just going to read you Kim's biography here. It'll give you a little bit of an idea of what she's on about. It says, Kim has been on a lifelong spiritual journey of adventure, healing, and connection to animals and our beautiful planet. She's a licensed human and certified animal bodywork therapist. As creator and director of the School of Applied Integrative Therapy, offering a 500-hour nationally approved certified equine bodywork practitioner program, Kim shares her approach to this incredible work. We strive to share a wonderful blend of art and science with focus on engaging our hands, hearts, and intuition to tap into amazing depths of not only physical, but emotional and spiritual tension. And she's talking about emotional and spiritual tension in horses here. It says, when we are connected and grounded, we're able to use our knowledge and skills to transmute and shift heavy tension and trauma into a lighter form. Kim has got a great story, one of those stories that it's like she's lived 10 lifetimes. Some of the things she told me in this interview, I'm like, you did what? And what happened? So, yeah. What an amazing lady and an amazing story. So I can't wait for you guys to listen to this podcast, and I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. Kim Keziah Sherrod, welcome to the Journey On podcast.
Thank you. I'm really blessed and happy to be here. Thank you.
I'm excited about this. In charge of you teach at the School of Applied Integrative Therapy for equines. Okay, so you kind of sound like you have a bit of a normal kind of if you're around horse people, something like that sounds pretty normal. But there's a whole background behind that goes almost into paranormal territory. So I'm excited to unpack that. So tell us a bit about the School of Applied Integrative Therapy for horses.
Integrative therapy.
Yes. What exactly do you guys do then?
Yeah. So the school is, it's a 500-hour program certified equine practitioners in massage and bodywork therapies. It's a nice little way to bring people in and let horses start to change a lot of our perceptions. But I do believe in standards. And so it is approved by the National Board for Animal Massage and Acupressure. It does testing. So everyone that graduates can be board certified. So I do believe in the standards, but I also believe that there's a piece of horses that just can't be explained. That horse leads us on a journey. And so the fun thing is everybody that goes through the program does make some kind of transformation, and that's the most beautiful piece. And horses lead that. So it's a trick.
That's cool. Now, let me ask this. Do people know they're signing up for a transformational experience, or do they think they're going to learn how to have some skills that they can actually have a job working with horses?
I think it's both. I do say in the sales page, and if anybody wants to talk, if going down that road is not your thing, then this is not where you want to be. I mean, I don't want to actually trick anybody, but it's right out there that you have to be willing to do the work, be willing to look, and we don't force anybody to go down the woo-woo road, but just to take a look at it and see what works. When we do the 6-day live intensive, which people can do after about 300 hours online, that's when the magic starts to happen, because we have our hands on horses and we get to experience what really happens when hands touch a body and you start to get the vibrations between the two of us and what actually happens. And yeah, there's science and there's all that peace and there's modalities and different things, but there's magic that happens. And
you know, it sounds like you got all the bases covered. So, you know, on your website it says the school's approved by NBCAAM, which is what you mentioned a minute ago, and thus contains all the required materials, including theory, anatomy, physiology, kinesiology, ethics, and business. And it says our professional graduates are qualified to sit for the NBCAAM National Board Exam. So it seems like it covers all the bases, covers the left brain, the right brain, like covers all the bases. It's not just physiology, kinesiology, ethics, and business, but it's also not just the woo. It sounds like it's all in there.
Yeah, the blend of art and science, which we really need to have. I mean, one without the other. And I am a more right brain, that person. So I've had to work really hard. I went to veterinary technology school. I thought for a while I wanted to be a veterinarian. So in my 30s, I went back and finished all my pre-vet requirements, hung out at the WSU, which is in Washington, as I was applying for vet school, and realized this isn't what I want to do. I want to do this stuff. So what am I about to spend $100,000 for when I'm a single mom?
When Kim said this stuff, she held up both her hands. Okay, so let me unpack that bit then. So when you were in your 30s, you thought, I want to be a vet. So you started going to vet school. But then you said, no, that's not what I want to do. I want to do this stuff. So this energy stuff. So what were you doing before your 30s? What's the story there? I'll tell you what. Let's start at the beginning. Where did you grow up?
I was born and grew up until I was 11 in the Black Hills of South Dakota. Wow. So I had a lot of influence from the Lakota people there.
There's the answer to the reason I ask about people's childhoods is you know what I was gonna ask you was. It seems like you might be in touch with some senses that society kind of drums out of us. And I was going to kind of go down the path like, have you always had those senses? Did your parents encourage them? And then you tell me you grew up in the Black Hills of South Dakota and had a lot to do with the Lakota people. So, okay, all makes sense now. Yeah. Sorry, continue on.
Yeah, and then I had these two very young, creative, passionate parents. My mom was still in high school when she had me, and they just had so much going on in their lives. They had so many dreams and so much fire, so they left me alone a lot. So I spent a lot of time with nature, and my mom always had horses around, so that's what I talked to, and that's what influenced me. And then having that native background, my parents divorced pretty young, two great big pieces of fire, just can't quite survive each other. And we lived in an area in Rapid City, and it was during the Wounded Knee uprisings with AIM. Yeah. And a lot of those people lived on our streets. And I started to have this where I felt really bad for having blonde hair and being white, and had to really work through that piece. My mom was writing for a magazine, so she was trying to get some of the AIM members were kidnapping, so to speak, journalists and taking them to tell their story. So she was down trying to get kidnapped. And I was seeing the people on our street with the AIM on their doors. And
what is that? What is,
I really
what
wanted
is,
to know their story. It was the American Indian Movement. Okay, yeah. And it was in the 70s, and there was an uprising in our area. It was, I just really took that on. And it was a time where most girls my age had probably, I don't know who, Donny Osmond or something on their walls. I had the Time magazine cover of the leaders of the AIM movement on mine. So it was just kind of a personal, I was always attracted to, wanted to know about religions and always studied them right from an early time. But that was the path that just kept the nature, speaking to nature and earth and animals and plants. That's where I got my, yeah. And then when I was 11, we ended up moving with my dad down in Southwest Colorado, and he worked for the Ute Mountain Ute Indian tribe. So he would come home with stories all the time. And he really liked to go down the path of some of the stories that a lot of people don't hear, some of the spirit stories. And so I got more influence that way. And then
can I interrupt for a second? What was he, what did he do for them? Yeah.
He was an economic developer, for them.
So, was that on a reservation?
He didn't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm,
he didn't work there just 2 or 3 years, perhaps, but the influence was there. And the Southwest area has a lot of really neat stories and influence. And then he was, just life was hard when you're really a passionate person that wants a lot out of life, and you're raising 5 kids, and there was 3 of us, and we had a stepmom with 2 kids, and he started drinking pretty heavy and got very physically abusive, and so just I learned what trauma is on a real severe basis, and my go-to was to run down to the river and just let the river take away all of that. But I spent a long time in my life trying to figure it out, because he also was a really kind and he had a good heart. He loved to have fun. So it's a real confusing thing when somebody's not that way all the time, but you never know when it's going to come. So I spent years just running. I remember, I know you talk about the freeze response and such, and I remember one of the last times my dad was beating on me, and he had my head, and he was hitting me on a rock, and I remember I was above myself watching it, and I could look right in his eyes and say, this will be the last time this ever happens. And I never left, because I had 2 little brothers that I worried about, and I didn't want to leave them. But there was such power in that, because I wasn't in my body, and I thought, I can't feel this. And so I thought after that, there wasn't much that scared me, because, once you go through that and you realize you can kind of step out of it. So it took me a long time. So I went down a lot of rabbit holes trying to figure out life and who I was. And
yeah, that's a lot to have to deal with it. Young age, and imagine that those experiences kind of shaped where your life went for a while. Imagine, did it?
Yeah. When I finally got away from that, I stayed for a while after I graduated. I worked 3 jobs, and all my money was going to the family. And finally, my boyfriend at the time and my grandfather said, "You have to get out of there." So I did. And I tried to go to Denver and go to college, but big city wasn't for me. And my mom was back in the Black Hills, so I went back there and went to veterinary technology school. And at that time, met a friend. We started college together, and we were sitting at the rodeo club meeting, and we both said, "I don't know why girls can't ride bulls at the same time." And we've been best friends ever since. But she had the same connection to the indigenous people and to earth and to horses. So from there, our friendship really grew. And I was about the time I was going to graduate, she wanted to go to Alaska. And she always talked about wanting to go to Alaska. And I said, "Sure, let's go." So she flew up there. We were going to drive together, but she had a truck that wasn't going very good. So I went to visit. My mom by then was living out in Los Angeles. I went out there and stayed for a month, made a little money, and drove my 2-wheel drive pickup up in January up to Alaska.
That's a long drive.
It was a long drive. And I on the way up, somewhere probably about where you live. My truck was overheating and I stopped somewhere and they said it was my thermostat, and but we don't have one. So they took it out and they said, but before you get to cold country, you probably ought to get one, right, or your heater won't work. Yeah. I never did find one. So I was driving. It was so cold. I couldn't turn my truck off. I had a dog and a cat with me. And it was an incredible drive. I made it. And sometimes I don't know how, but I did. Got up and met my friend and she...
Where in Alaska did you drive?
I drove to Anchorage because she was. And it was, of course, it was before cell phones. So you're calling somebody at home from a payphone and they're calling. And then you get in Canada and you don't call anybody because the price back then. And we found each other and she informed me that she was getting married and her husband was going to come get her next week. So I had $20 and a dog and a cat and a pickup. And I found a job with an old fur trader for $5 a day. And he finally said he had a place I could stay. And we went down south of Anchorage and it was a house that had been condemned. So the back half was gone. And I hung up some blankets and there was no water or anything. And just kind of a place to sleep. And
so he was an old fur trader?
Yeah, he was a fur trader. Yeah, fur and ivory and guns and whatever it took. And so I saved a couple dollars out of my everyday $5. And I heard they're up north of Anchorage in Wasilla area, uh-huh, Palmer area. I heard there was horses. Yep.
I've done so a clinic I've done two clinics up there. One was in Palmer and one was in, okay, went back the next year and did one in Wasilla too. So yeah, there was horses up there. Yeah.
Okay. So you know, right, yeah, where it was. Yeah, it was. I found a job at the Matsu Guest Ranch, but I had to go back and work enough to get enough money to drive back a second time. And so then I worked there for the whole rest of the year. And it was crazy. And take these people out on rides through the bears and the cranes. And for some reason, the man that owned it, he didn't let the people guiding have saddles. I don't know why. So we were all out there bareback managing these guests. And it was quite an adventure. And I finally went home. My great grandpa was turning 100, so I drove home for that.
Yeah. So riding bareback in bear country, how's that?
I don't think I was old enough, right, to know,
right,
better.
Didn't think about it.
I think I was 20, 21 years old. It just was like, well, that's strange, but okay. Yep. Yeah.
And so you went back for your great grandfather's 100th birthday. Was this in the Black Hills?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I bet he had some amazing stories.
He had incredible stories. He was a pretty incredible human being, and he had great stories.
So what year would that have been?
He lived to 101. Oh, my goodness. Well, let's see. 84 maybe?
So he was born in like 1884. Mm-hmm. So he would be he would have very clear memories of the turn of the century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. There's stories, reporters came and he started several businesses. He owned a bank in the Depression, lost everything trying to keep it open and couldn't. And he had great stories. And he was quite an inspiration for me. He had just to keep going and how you can just keep picking up and keep going. And
wow. Yeah. So after vet school, your attempt at vet tech school.
Well, I'll just tell you what happened after I came back for that party. So my girlfriend got married, and she just wasn't sure. She was quite done with adventure. And I was working at another trail ride place. And we were talking one evening and she said, I just feel like getting on horse and just like getting out of here and riding somewhere. And I said, where do you want to ride? And she said, I don't know, maybe Arizona. I said, okay, because I was still in that age. And So we ended up taking off. I had like a half broke Arabian horse and she had a horse. And the place I was working, it was when they still brought horses to different locations and they'd unfortunately go to slaughter. But my boss said, "Hey, two mules just came in. Do you want them?" So I got these two little mules that were unbroke and we packed them up and off we went on our adventure. It was fall already when we took off and we rode through South Dakota and some of Nebraska and Wyoming and we had no money. So we'd stop and work at different ranches and things along the way. And that was quite an adventure and learned a lot. Stayed in some graveyard church in the plains of Nebraska through a blizzard that was just horrendous. Even brought the animals in. We felt so
I was going to say, did you leave the mules outside or they come inside?
Well, we did. We brought them in the church. I'm sorry to anybody who hears this now.
Hey, there was a donkey in the nativity scene, so don't feel so bad.
There you go. Yeah. And we ended up riding on. We finally made it to Laramie, Wyoming. Again, we were out of money. And we decided quickest way to make money in a college town is to work in the college bar. So we lived in the stall at the fairgrounds. We didn't think anybody knew we were there, but we would clean up in the, some Taco John's or something and work at the bars at night. And then her husband came and said, "This is it. My wife's not working in a bar. You guys are going to borrow money or this is it." And I wouldn't take money. So she went home with him and I stayed for a while. And then I took off. I didn't even know where I was going or why at that point. Just going, I guess. And at that point, I met somebody. I was riding down the road. I finally left. It was day before Thanksgiving. And cars would go by. They'd see somebody with two mules and a dog and a horse and gawk quite a bit. But this one vehicle would drive by and slow down, and I'd see it drive by again, and something just caused me to walk right over to the window and say, "Hey, what's up?" And it was a fella, and he just flat out said, "I'm a medicine man, and I've been looking for an apprentice, and I think you're it." And I was like, "Well, cool, okay, let's do this thing."
Really?
So that turned into quite a fiasco. I learned a lot, and I unfortunately learned what happens when somebody takes their medicine and goes the wrong way with it. I wasn't exactly sure I'd get out of there alive, but I did.
So when you say someone takes medicine, goes the wrong way with it, what sort of medicine and what is the wrong way?
Let's just say.
And what? I've got a lot of questions.
Yeah.
If you want to say what the medicine is, what goes wrong and what is there a part of the person that causes it to go wrong? Like, is there, is it old stuff coming up? Can you go into that a little bit?
What I found, you can, once you learn how to really control energy and in that kind of a way, and I know who trained him. So he was he was powerful. And I don't know how much to say. I always said I'd never say anything till I knew he was dead, which he is. But he was using the medicine. People were paying him to do jobs, like take care of things. And
it's interesting.
Yeah. And then once I wanted to.
It's interesting you said that because, talking to Rupert Isaacson about hunter-gatherers and shamans and stuff, he said the hunter-gatherers, the true hunter-gatherers, the shamans never ever used their powers for evil. But he said any of the, once they got into like warrior tribes, once they were no longer hunter-gatherers, some shamans would use their powers for evil. And it sounds like this may have been a case of that.
Yeah. I mean, he used it for good things too. And once I figured out what was going on, and again, it's before cell phones, and the only way I have out of there is my horse. And he didn't want me to leave. And so it got a little tricky for a while. And finally, I convinced him that I wanted to go meet my brother, who was going to be on the other in Colorado in Steamboat Springs over the mountain. He was going to be there for a party or something. And I convinced him I wanted to just go there. And then my brother was living in Aspen, Colorado. So I was going to, somehow he agreed. But he said, you know, I don't really, it's middle of December. The passes are 12-foot cutouts, no drifts. I don't want you riding. And I said, okay. So he was going to take me, but we didn't get very far out of town and we got in a big fight and he threw me out on the side of the road. And so I ended up riding that night, walking, I should say. I didn't do much riding with my two mules and my horse and my dog. And we'd all spread out on the road going up the pass, find somewhere non-slippery to be, and the car would come and you'd get all together and you'd go out. And it was probably 2 or 3 in the morning and I was not even to the top yet. And some old fella in his old beat-up pickup truck pulls up and he says, what are you doing out here? If my daughter was, I'd take you over my knee. And I said, well, I don't know. I'm going to Arizona. I don't know. And so he said, when you get to the top, there's one of those sheds where they keep all the snow plows. He said, I'm going to go tell them that you're coming and you're going to stay there. And I'm going home and getting a trailer and this trip is over. So he did and took me home and his wife made me hot chocolate and I slept in a nice bed that night. And then I went to Aspen where my brother and my uncle were and I got a job and I found somewhere to board my horse and my mules. And I got a job at a 5-star restaurant that did sled dog tours also. And I had nowhere to live, so I put my tent up in the trees where the ski slopes come down between them. I put my tent up in that, and I lived up there for the winter. And they had a shower, so I could be fancy for the 5-star restaurant.
You lived in a tent while working in a 5-star restaurant. That's a bit of a juxtaposition right there.
Yeah, it was pretty funny. It just shows people talk, you know, I always hear people say, well, I was homeless and I never felt homeless. My home was the earth. It was just, to me being smart, why would I waste my money on finding somewhere to rent? I just want to make some money and figure out what I'm doing, I guess.
The medicine man that you left there to go over the mountain pass at the middle of the night, sounds like there was some not good stuff about that, but did you learn a lot of good stuff from him too?
I did. I learned a lot of how to work with energies and different, you know, how everything has a vibration. And I learned how to start. But the big thing I really learned that from him was ethics and how not to use that, you know, and how to use it only for good and how we should never. And that's a piece of what I teach in the equine massage school is we have to ask permission for every piece. Like we can't just affect anything just because we can. And we have to have permission. And sometimes what we think is best for somebody isn't what's best for them.
Yeah, and that permission's been coming up. The more I talk to, people who are into indigenous practices and things like that, even like cutting a limb off a tree or pulling a plant out of the ground or, you know, like harvesting it, picking a tomato or, you know, like things like that. From what I've heard, Indigenous people had such a connection to everything. They understood the sentience of everything so that they would, they would ask permission before doing anything, really.
Anything at all. Yeah, everything has a voice. Everything, you know, we're these humans that have to survive off of all, you know, other life to survive. Another life has to survive, but to be show our gratitude and say thank you.
Yeah, that's the thing that it includes gratitude, but also I think it is, it's almost like a mental health practice. You know, instead of picking a tomato while thinking about what you're going to cook with it or what you're going to watch on TV tonight or whatever it is whatever story's going on in your head, you've got to, if you stop and ask the tomato plant, can I pick the tomato, right then you are present and in the moment. And I think that, I mean, there's so much to just that act, isn't there? There is the awareness of the sentience of other things. There is the gratitude, like, may I, not just taking it for granted. And then there's the mental health part, the being present, not being in your head, not being thinking about the next thing, but slowing down and being right there. So I think there's I don't think those sorts of indigenous practices are a one-shot thing, like, oh, you do this because, oh, it's a sentient being, so we're going to recognize it's a sentient being. But there's also a lot of other stuff going on there too that I think is good for us.
And as, skipping ahead, as I started to, I always avoided the word shamanism, but it's become a thing you almost have to use. And now that I have been studying it very in depth, but you're always told it's not a religion, it's a way of life. Like, it's just a way of life. It's how you live. I have some pots of herbs outside and I needed to harvest them before the frost came, and just being with that and cutting it all off. And I mean, I started to cry. It's just so, thank you. And thank you for all that you're going to bring to us with what we have out of what we're going to get from you. And it's just being so blended with all of life. And
so you said weren't going to jump ahead to your shamanic stuff. So let's stay where we're at. So you've left, you've ridden away in the middle of the night, you got kicked out of the truck. Mm-hmm. Am I to assume there was an element of being held against your will there?
And there would be just enough little bit of medicine there to make me know that there was some control. Like, suddenly I'd see playing with a little pipe and doing some chants and I'd be running in the bathroom, puking my guts out. So it was just enough to say, just so you know. So I knew I had to play it pretty good. And I suppose the training I had growing up, knowing how to read people, you learn how to read people really well just to survive. And somehow I managed to figure that one out.
So you think, like, the incident you just talked about then, is that like a thinly veiled threat?
Say that again.
You know, you said that, like, he'd be chanting and playing with his pipe and then you'd have to go and throw up. Was that like a thinly veiled threat? Like, I can do things to you if you don't.
Mm-hmm. Just so you know.
Yeah. What's that like?
And at that point, I'd already figured out what he was doing on the side, so I knew. Yeah.
So what's, if you can, share with us, what's that like to, how was that living in that environment for you? I mean, you sound pretty blasé about it, but I think me and most people listening, like, that would be pretty horrifying sort of a situation be in. How did you handle that?
Well, I know I was scared. I just felt, again, having grown up like I did, I went years of not knowing what I was going to walk into in the house and really not knowing what was going to happen or how bad it was going to get. Or so I had that training, I guess, that in depth, knowing how to, I'm pretty good at just making it look like I'm okay, and underneath, I had Somebody I was taking horse lessons from once, he said, "You're like a duck on water. You're just as smooth as can be, and underneath your little feet are going like crazy." And so I was scared, but I just didn't. I was just going to figure it out, I guess. And again, there was no cell phones. There was no way to, you know, I guess I didn't feel threatened enough to like run out and call the cops or something. Because what are you going to tell them?
Right.
Yeah. And I probably wasn't as afraid as I should be, but.
It's a bit like the riding bareback in bear country.
Yeah. All the things, you're just kind of just going along with life, living in
right.
the moment.
Okay. So you've kind of got away from there. You've got to the top of the hill. I think we've got to the top of the hill.
Now I'm in Aspen.
Now you're living in a tent, working at a 5-star restaurant. Where does your story go from there?
From there, yeah. So I met my partner for 8 years and the father of my daughter there. He was one of the sled dog drivers.
Of course, you had a child with a sled dog driver. I mean, that's just like, just sounds like pretty normal for where you're going to.
Yeah. He ended up working there for a few more years. I would come back sometimes, but one winter.
I got lots of questions. On your daughter's birth certificate where it says father's occupation, does it say sled dog driver?
Does it say occupation?
I don't know if it does in America. In Australia, it says, at least when I was born, on my birth certificate, it's got mother's and father's occupation.
I don't remember if it does.
It's just such a cool title, you know.
Once again.
Sled dog driver.
Yeah, right. Once again. So we did that back and forth, and I'll get back to my daughter's piece of it. But and then 1 year, our boss decided to run the Iditarod sled dog race. So we went up with him to handle for that. And so we were up in Alaska, and Mark did most of that stuff. But I was there helping to train through that whole winter, and we went to Nome. And
really,
it was quite an experience.
That's one of those things that...
Yeah.
If someone had that one experience in their life, I got to go to Alaska to train dogs for the Iditarod. They'd be like, that's the pinnacle of cool stuff in their life. And for you, that's just like, oh, yeah, went up to Alaska and, you know, trained dogs for the Iditarod. Okay, next, you know.
Yeah. So we came down from there and... For the summer, we decided we were going to wildcraft herbs in Washington, in the mountains. We got down there, and this is where some spirit stuff comes in. But I used to get really bad sight aches, and they would come and they would go. I was pretty used to them. We were camping in the mountains, and this time it was so bad and it lasted so long that we had made the decision we'd go the next day to the doctor and see what the heck's going on. And that night I was leaning up against a tree. I just couldn't sleep very well. And I'm looking out into the distance and I see coming out of the distance this woman. And she has this long blonde hair and this white dress and she's glowing. And I thought, wow, how sick am I? And I see this vision coming toward me, and she said, "You know, a doctor's not going to help you, right?" And I said, "Well, I really like what you suggest." And she said, "What you need to do is you need to go to these particular hot springs." I didn't know about them. She told me where they were. You go to these hot springs, and when you get there, have a massage, which I had never had a massage before. And then she said, when you feel better, then you need to go to massage school. I didn't even know there was such a thing as a massage school. So in the morning, we got up, we went and looked at our map. Sure enough, where she said it was about 100 miles away, there was these hot springs. We get to the hot springs, and sure enough, there's massage therapists there, and I felt better. And so then I thought, well, I need to look into this thing, this massage school thing, and again, it was before internet, so you go to a bookstore, a health food store, and you get a magazine, and you look through the ads in the back, and It took me several years. I collected names and I'd send for information. And by the time you get it, you've moved. And it took me quite a while to finally do it. But I did do it. It was the best thing I ever did was go. I went to Santa Fe. But before that, I ended up having my daughter, who is just the light of my life. And so she was born in a teepee. And
of course,
we had a midwife, but yeah. So I don't know what it says on her birth certificate for occupation, but but she was born in a teepee in Wisconsin. And yeah, and then I went to massage school in Santa Fe.
Let's talk about the woman with the white hair and the white coat, the blonde hair and the white coat.
Yeah.
Up to that point in time, had you had anything like that happen to you? Like with the when you were with the medicine man and stuff, did you get spirits, visions, any of those things before that?
Yeah. So now you hear about journeying as it's a form of meditation where you can go on an actual journey, and a lot of times animals will take you there. It was only 20 years ago, maybe 15, that I heard that word, but I didn't. That's what I did.
Right.
Like, that's how I escaped as a child. So I'd go close my eyes, and then an animal would come get me and take me. So I was used to that. Nothing that I know of ever showed up without me, like going into meditation. Right. Like, this one was like wide-eyed. It just shows up. Yeah. So, and she has been with me ever since. So,
does she have a name?
I give her names, but she's never told me her name. Okay. Yeah.
And does she show up? Now, does she only show up when you journey, or does she?
Mostly when I talk with her. Yeah, when I'm on a journey of some kind, then. And I can call on her if I need her, but that was the only time, like, just like right there. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So you go to massage school in Santa Fe, New Mexico, which is a rather spiritual kind of a place anyway.
Yeah. So Mark was back. By then he was doing the sled dog tours in Jackson, Wyoming. So he stayed for that winter. I took my daughter and we went down, and it was an incredible experience. I asked him, I didn't know anybody ever had done this, but I said, could I do some of my internship on horses? And they said, well, we don't know anything about that, but if you can find someone to mentor you a little bit, sure. So I found this little guy. He was from Mexico. He worked on the tracks in Albuquerque, and he showed me what he knew. And it was much more aggressive than I would have ever worked, but I did learn enough to do my internship. So that's kind of where the horse thing started.
And where did it go from there? Where did you go from there? More to the point.
Where did I go from there? Yeah, I went back to Jackson, Wyoming, where my partner was. Then we ended up splitting up. We're still very, very good friends. And he still does the sled dog tours in Telluride, Colorado. Yeah. And I went up to Moran Junction, which is up between Yellowstone and the Tetons, and worked just at different places. He did my massage here and there. At that point, my daughter was getting a little older. She in school and that. So I ended up in Northwest Montana, on another Indian reservation. Some of my dearest friends are from there now. And she went to a little school with Indian kids, and I worked for the school, and she went to grade school there. And then I moved back to South Dakota again when she went through junior high and high school. And that's when I went through some of my, during that time while she was going to school is when I finished my pre-vet stuff. Yeah. And then kind of went through what I call my normal period in life. as normal as it gets right. for me. Yeah. And worked at a veterinary clinic, managed a big veterinary clinic, and trained different horses. And then I met the man I'm married to now, and we came to Wyoming, and we bought a place. He works. He's an electrician at a power plant. So I always tell him we both work in electricity.
You both work in the energy sector.
Yeah, we both work in energy. But we bought some land, and we lived in a little tiny house with no running water for a year and a half while we built our house. And that's where we're at now.
So,
and in the process, yeah, I started to study the shamanic work with some of the teachers that are out there, Sandra Ingerman and The Four Winds with Alberto Villaldo. I finished his energy medicine course, starting the master course, and I just found out I was accepted as one of to go do kind of an internship in Chile with my teachers and mentors in February. So I'll be there for a month.
You'll be in Chile in February. I'll be next mm-hmm. door in Argentina in February.
You'll be doing the Gaucho Derby. Ride. Yeah.
Actually, I'm actually going to fly out of Santiago, Chile. So I will probably be in Chile at the same time you are.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Yeah, that's where I'll fly into.
So tell me about...
When is the Gaucho Derby?
Gaucho Derby is... well, I think I get done in... excuse me. I think I get done in Argentina around the 20, maybe 2nd or something or other. So I imagine I'm probably going to get down there about the 5th, I think, something like that. So it's in the middle of, you know, the race itself, you get 10 days to complete the race. The winners do it in about 7. Wow. After 10 days, if you're not finished, they come get you. but, you know... Usually when I'm talking to someone about the Gaucho Derby, it's like, yeah, I'm doing the Gaucho Derby. You've lived the Gaucho Derby. I mean, that story riding up the hill in the middle of the night in the snow with the horse and the two mules is like, the Gaucho Derby's nothing on that. So I don't even want to talk about the Gaucho Derby with you.
I don't know. I'm pretty impressed.
So tell me about one of the things I read about you is that you, where is it here? You, something about, okay. So you originally graduated from the Four Winds Practitioner course in energy medicine and Andean shamanism. Tell me about shamanism from the Andes. And how did you get into that? How did that start?
And how did it? Yeah, so that was through Alberto Villaldo's program.
So who is Alberto?
He's a medical. Yeah, he has the Four Winds Society, and he was a medical anthropologist and traveled all over and really learned a lot from the Quechua people in Peru, and just kept going back there. And he had several health issues and whatnot that they helped him with. And over time, they asked him to start taking their teachings back, knowing that our planet's in some trouble right now. And they have been told that they should share what they know and whatnot. And they've asked him to do so. So he has spent 2 or 3 decades building this and sharing this, married a woman from Chile who also has really joined this mission. And so they put together they have lots of short courses and things if anybody wants to just dip their toe in. It's thefourwinds.com. And the energy medicine course, you can do it live. I chose to do it online, which is a 6-month, very, very intense course. And then now I've started into the master program. And then, like I said, I was just accepted to go be one of the apprentices for a month. So it's a really nice program. I thought about it for over 10 years, looking into it, trying to decide. And I still don't know what I'm going to do with. We learned how to do a lot of healing practices, which I could have a healing practice. I feel like my mission in life is more to inspire and bring a message out than do the work. I have to do the work to know what it is. But one of the neat things about that lineage that I learned through Alberto is when we talk about chakras and the chakra system, it actually came from, you know, where we think of like India and the Himalayas, and it went up through Russia and down through Alaska and down through the Hopi and all the way down to Peru. And so when we do a lot of the healing work, we're working with chakra energy centers. So I thought that was really interesting.
Very. You know, I just looked, up the fourwinds.com. I just want to read, if you don't mind, I want to read about Alberto. So it says here, how do you pronounce his last name? Valoldo? Is that it?
Vialdo. Okay. Yeah, he was originally from
okay,
Cuba.
Okay, so the two L's is a Y. Okay. So it says, by his mid-20s, Alberto Vialdo was the youngest clinical professor at San Francisco State University. He was directing the Biological Self-Regulation Laboratory. That sounds interesting. Investigating how energy medicine could change the chemistry of the brain. One day in his laboratory, Alberto realized that his research had to get bigger instead of smaller, that he was looking out of the wrong end of the microscope. He needed to find a system larger than the neural networks of the brain. Many others were already studying the hardware. Alberto wanted to learn the program, the mind to create psychosomatic health. And we can talk about psychosomatic health in a minute because I think that's fascinating. Anthropological stories hinted that there were people around the globe who claimed to know such things, including the few remaining shamans in today's modern world. Alberto traded his laboratory for a pair of hiking boots and a ticket to the Amazon, determined to learn from researchers whose vision had not been confined to the lens of a microscope, from people whose body of knowledge encompassed more than the measurable material world that he'd been taught was the only reality. He wanted to meet the people who sense the spaces between. Oh, this is cool. He wanted to meet the people who sense the spaces between things and perceive the luminous strands that animate all life. Scattered throughout the Andes and Amazon were a number of sages or earth keepers who remembered the ancient ways. Alberto traveled through countless villages and hamlets and met with scores of medicine men and women. The lack of a written body of knowledge meant that every village had brought its own flavor and style to the healing program that still survived. Healing practices that still survived. For more than 10 years, Alberto trained with the jungle medicine people in healing his own soul wounds. We can talk about that too. Alberto walked the path of the wounded healer and learned to transform old pain, grief, anger, and shame to sources of strength and compassion. Whew. From the Amazon, Alberto trekked the coast of Peru from Nazca, the site of gigantic markings on the desert floor that depict power animals and geometric figures, to the fabled Shimbe Lagoons in the north, home to the country's most renowned shamans. Then in Lake Titicaca, I didn't want to say that, but that's what it is, Titicaca, the sea on top of the world, Alberto collected the stories and healing practices of the people from which the legends they say the Inca were born. Through it all, Alberto discovered a set of technologies that transforms the body, heals the soul, and can change the way we live and the way we die. These ancient teachings explain that a luminous energy field surrounds us and acts as a matrix or a blueprint that maintains the health and vibrancy of the physical body. Alberto is the founder of the world-renowned Four Winds Society and of the Light Body School. In his teachings and writings, he shares the experience of infinity and its ability to heal and transform us, to free us from the temporal chains that keep us fettered to illness, old age, and disease. Holy cow. And this is the guy you learnt some from.
Yeah. And that I'll get to spend time with in Chile, so I'm really excited.
Okay, so I got some questions here, but I want you to expound on. So it said Alberto wanted to learn the program, to program the mind and to create psychosomatic health. Can you explain to people what psychosomatic health is?
No. I know that as we do the work, we go in, we can go in and track. That's what we learned to do, where different traumas and different things that happen to us, different memories, and maybe they are traumas that come through our lineage. We've inherited them and we carry them with us. And maybe if you believe that way, and it doesn't matter if you don't, but you know, perhaps we brought it in from another life and we have things to work with. So we can go in and track where these different things live. Then we learned how you could learn how to go into the past, into what they call the lower world track, and find these things and help to bring them out and heal, find the messages to help heal those. And as Alberto said, you know, what happens to us in life is just a story. It's the stories we tell about it, or how we want to keep holding on or live with it, that is what the problem is. And so, yeah, we learn to work in that, and then we can learn to work in the upper world, where we can go track a destiny. Because I know a lot of people and some very close people in my life that say, I just don't feel like I have a purpose. I'm not like you. I don't have this drive, but I do think we all have it. And I think that if we don't allow ourselves to search and find that purpose and at least try to live it to where our soul is calling us, we end up with depression and different things. So by being able to track and start to aligning ourselves with what our soul is calling for, is very helpful.
You know, that was really interesting. I said, can you explain what psychosomatic health is? And you said, no. And then you went and explained exactly what psychosomatic health, you know, psychosomatic health, as far as I know, would be things like, for instance, say fibromyalgia, okay, which is intense pain in the body. They now believe that fibromyalgia is caused by trauma, which means it's not a physical thing in the body. It's not a, like my liver's not working, or, you know, I've got a hole in my intestine. It's not a physical thing. Fibromyalgia apparently is, you know, psychosomatic. So, healing all those traumas can unravel that. So what else did it say here I wanted to ask you about? Where it said he was determined to learn from researchers whose vision had not been confined to the lens of a microscope, from people whose body of knowledge encompassed more than the measurable material world that he had been taught was the only reality. And isn't it, I mean, you've kind of lived in that since you were a kid, but for the rest of us, it's kind of an eye-opener to get to the point to where the only reality you've been taught, you realize that's not the only reality.
Yeah, it's such a narrow scope and focus that we are taught, and especially in these modern societies, it's so small. And when I was living the way I lived, I mean, tents, teepees, backs of trucks for so long, like I said, I never felt homeless. I just felt I was on a journey. However, you'd have to almost fight your way to have permission to live like that. People in our country don't even let you live like that.
Sorry, I'm laughing here because on the bottom of this page about Alberto, it's got his, he's the author of numerous best-selling books. So recently I was in Costa Rica. My son and I were in Costa Rica, and there's kind of two Costa Rica stories I want to tell you here, but one was, so we're in San Jose, the capital of Costa Rica, and we went to the Gold Museum. So it's the museum about the history of gold in Costa Rica. But so it's full of all these gold artifacts, but almost every single one of them is like the shape of an animal, and it was used in shamanic ceremonies. So you're going to the Gold Museum, but really you're going to the Shaman Museum sort of thing, you know what I mean? Which
How
was
cool.
really cool. Lots of frogs, big time on the frogs.
Could you feel the energy off of those things?
It was because these are old artifacts, and like it was so cool. But anyway, so then we go and visit a former podcast guest, Nan Zintzmaster. So Nan is Carolyn Resnick's head facilitator. And so I went and stayed with Nan and her husband, Z. And Z is like, there's something, I mean, Nan's very, very cool too, but Z's like, there's something going on there with that dude, you know. They live, their house overlooks a lake, and right beside their house on one side is a volcano. And I don't mean it's like 15 miles off in the distance. It's right there. a volcano, perfect volcano. So if anybody's been to Costa Rica, they live in, I think it's called Arenal is the area. But anyway, there's a volcano right there. And Z was showing me pictures of this volcano with lava flowing down its sides. It wasn't blowing its top, but there's lava flowing down its sides. And they were living right there when this was happening, okay? And I said to him, so what is it like to live beside a volcano with lava flowing down its sides? And he looks at me and he goes, the veil is very thin.
Oh,
anyway, awesome. So he gave me a book, okay, while I was there. I haven't read it yet. Mm-hmm. It's on my pile of books. But when I scroll down to the bottom of the page by Alberto Villaldo, one of the books he wrote is called Shaman Sealer Hage. Shaman Healer Sage, How to Heal Yourself and
Healer
Others
Sage.
With
it's
the Energy
great.
And Medicine in the Americas. I have that book sitting on my pile of books here. I didn't even read who wrote it. It's just this, it's got a really cool title, Shaman Healer Sage.
Yeah.
And Z gave me that book, and here we are talking, and you're telling me you're learning from this guy, and then I scroll down his biography, and he's wrote the damn book I've got sitting here. So, yeah. All the things
book.
Just got connected.
Yeah. The world is so small. It really
is. It is very small. So tell me about Andean shamanism.
Yeah, so in this case, again, it's based on the people, the Andean people, and there's several of them now, and those Quechua people, and they're all getting the same message to share. Again, through what's nice about Alberto's program, and I've studied with another Andean shaman, and he's from there. Alberto can bring the science piece to it, so it helps us to be able to talk to modern world and make more sense, less scary. And he can actually bring what's going on in the nervous system along with what we're doing, which is nice. So as with all shamanism, you're working with energies. In this particular lineage that we learned, like I said, we we track through the chakras and we find everything through the chakra. And then each chakra has an archetype. So we learn about the archetypes. We work with the directions, the four winds. Usually up here in North America, we always start, I always learn to start with the east and then the south and the west.
Because the north is north is like death, isn't it?
Yeah, but that lineage starts in the south. Maybe because of where they're from, the Southern Cross and whatnot. So they start in the south, and it has an archetype. In that case, the archetype is, they call it Sachamama, or the snake, the serpent.
Yeah, so I've been...
all ancient lineages.
So I've been...
Yeah, serpent.
I've been and done a 3-day ayahuasca ceremony. And they talk about Sachamama. And when you do ayahuasca... such a mama will come and appear to you, I tell you.
Oh, that's awesome. I have not done that yet, and I've been on this journey for 2 years of exploring every which way of the ayahuasca.
Well, I think, so do the Andean shamans, do they actually take any plant medicine, or is it all journeying like through drumming or...
No, they do plant medicine. They do the ayahuasca, and then they do like the Apuachuma, San Pedro. And I'm sure many others.
Yep.
I did a course with, it was online, but how we blended with the plant spirits of ayahuasca and Apuachuma, and that was really cool. And then we put the energy into water and drank it, and it was a really neat course.
Okay, you can't just skim over that like that. That sounds fascinating. Tell me all about that. So it sounds like it's almost like you've summoned the spirits of ayahuasca, put it in water, then drank the water, and then had a vision.
So
what, tell us all about it.
The course was Freddy Puma Key Space in Gona through the Shift Network. And so I think it was 3 or 4 weeks, probably 4 weeks for each plant. And so he got us to know the plant. And then he'd send us out on homework through the week, going out and summoning the spirit of that plant, what it represents. And we did that for a few weeks, and he's just kept sending us on assignments. And he said he would talk to his mentors. He had started studying medicine or shamanism when he was six with his elders. And he just had this vision that he could accomplish this online through, you know, distance. I think he started doing it distance, and then he tried this thing with through the computer. And then on the last day, we had really become embodied that spirit of that plant. And then we took it and we blew it into the water. And then we did ceremony around the water through the class. And then we were able to drink. And he said, you'll get the same effects without the bodily effects. But you take in the spirit of that medicine. And it was really neat. And so I felt like I really got to know the spirit of those plants. And
So when you drank the water, what happened?
You know, it wasn't any instant thing for me. But you feel that just going into all of your cells and all that we learned about who that plant is and what it's trying to teach us and what we can learn from it and grow. And and I have so many people, I have plant medicine friends that do, that teach and facilitate plant medicine. And they always say, well, you already see all this stuff. So
right.
I don't know if you need it. And so I haven't figured out which way to go with it yet.
Yeah, it sounds like you don't need it. Like, the, you know, I think the plant medicine is the shortcut. It's kind of like, do you know who Ram Dass is or was?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he did lots of LSD back in the 60s with Timothy Leary. But he said after a while, he realized that the point was not to do the LSD, like to keep doing LSD. LSD showed him what was possible, and then it was his job to figure out how to do it without the LSD. And it sounds like you're doing the same thing. You can go to the places, awesome. You can go to the places that some people take, say, plant medicines like ayahuasca to get to, but you don't need to because you can get there anyway.
Yeah, that's what I'm playing with right now. I keep thinking, oh, it just sounds like such a transformative, amazing experience. But I just haven't gotten myself to that place where I know I'm ready or I don't know what.
Yeah, well, it's one of those things from the bit I know of it is it gives you the experience you need, not the experience you want. Like everybody's experience with it is completely, yeah. completely different. And I know someone recently who did her second ayahuasca experience. And what's funny is in my experience, it was all just dark, nasty stuff. You know what I mean? I've told people that the ayahuasca just cracks you open and you look into the abyss at all the stuff you hate about yourself. And when I was in Costa Rica recently, we went on a whale watching trip is what we're doing there. And we're with two former podcast guests, Kerry Lake and then Terry Keebler. And one night, so Terry does a lot of shamanic journeying. And we're sitting around one night talking about stuff and Terry was talking about her guides and things, you know. And I said, you know, with the plant medicine that I have done, I've not ever seen like a, like my divine self or I've had a guide, a spirit guide, a mentor, and I haven't had any of that show up. It's just been all nasty, dark sort of stuff, you know. And it was, I have a therapist that I've been working with, and I've been doing a lot of what's called internal parts work, like internal family system stuff. And what it was getting to with that, with my therapist, is there's all these parts of us that are what we call exiled from us, you know, like the parts you don't like. And what you've got to start do is you've got to start to have a conversation with them and welcome them back in instead of not liking them.
You've got to keep them out.
Yeah, you've got to welcome them in. And so we've been working on that. And then this night in Costa Rica, I was telling Kerry that, you know, when I've done plant medicine, whatever, that there's been no guides and it's all been dark and nasty. And she said, if you do it again, okay, when you crack, when that ayahuasca cracks you open and you peer into the abyss, instead of going, ugh, that's all nasty stuff down there, look down there and go, hello, you guys okay down there? Looks awful dark. Would you like to come up here and hang out? Would you like a hug? And when she said that, I'm like, oh, it's only dark because I'm viewing it as dark and I'm rejecting it instead of accepting it and projecting love towards it. And so then recently I'm talking to this friend of mine who did a second ayahuasca weekend, and she said at one point in time the ayahuasca turned really dark, like there was this like demon-y, monster-y, beastie thing that showed up. And she said, I looked at it and laughed and went, who paid you $10 to dress up like a dragon? And it poof, it completely disappeared, and it was all light and love after that. And that was that was like, that's what Kerry told me. That's what my therapist had been talking about. If you reject that stuff and you exile it, like it is dark and nasty. Whereas if you bring it into the light and you give it a big old hug and you say, hey, how's it going? Good to see you. Nice to hang out with you. You feeling okay? Would you like a cup of tea, love, sort of thing? It's totally different. That. And I've got that line rehearsed in my head. If I ever need it again, who paid you $10 to dress up like a dragon?
I love it. I listened to the Aubrey Marcus podcast and the different he goes into ayahuasca a lot and the different experiences people have. And I see that, like, or I'm hearing that, yeah, if we don't want to look at things, then they just keep coming up and probably in life as well.
Yeah. Aubrey Marcus also has a good conversation on there with Dick Schwartz, who's the guy that developed internal family systems. And Dick Schwartz actually does like a therapy session, like, Aubrey Marcus is talking to Dick, and it's like they're in on the couch, you know, and Dick actually leads him through a whole thing. It was really cool. Probably the coolest part about it was as much work as Aubrey Marcus has done, there was still stuff to work on. And so it was like, okay, that's just a good reminder that you never finished.
Oh, man. And it's just work. Longer, I find myself, I'm going along and then – it's like that thing that you thought you worked through, it was over, you're done with it, it shows up again. It's like, are you freaking kidding me?
Yeah, but I mean, I think that's an exciting revelation when you get to the point to where you go, you're never done, so stop looking for the end. You know what I mean? Like, you know, it's like you can just get to like, okay, we're working through this and now we're working through this and now we're working through this. We're not, it's not like there's no place to get to, and it's kind of like, people with their helping people with their horses. You know, people say, oh, I've got this problem with this horse and I want to fix this problem. How do I fix this problem? And one of the things I say is, before I help you with this particular issue, you seem to be pretty bent out of shape about this particular issue. Like, you've got a lot of frustration about this issue. So before I help you with this issue, I need you to know that when you get through this one, there's going to be another one. And if you approach the next issue with the same frustration you're approaching this issue, life's going to suck. Yes. Horses is not going to be any fun. What you have to do is you have to be curious about the issue. Where's it coming from? Like, but it's not like it's a bad thing we want to get. It's almost like what Kerry Lake said, like, give it a big old hug. Like, hey guys, you know, like look at the problem as something to embrace, not something to reject, you know, something to be curious about. Because like I tell them, if you are as frustrated about the next thing as you are about this thing, your life with horses is going to be hell, because there's always something to work on. So you can't be frustrated, because there's no, it's not like, oh yes, it's all fixed and we're all good now. You know, there's just something else to work on. And I think life's like
just
that.
Just got to journey on, right?
You just got to journey on. You know what I might do? I might ask you the questions that you chose.
Okay.
That I wrote down here. And sometimes by the time we get to these, people have answered them. But, oh, you've got your glasses on. You're getting serious.
I'm like going to remember what I thought there.
Yeah, so when I ask you these questions, you have to remember that you emailed me to ask you these questions. So sometimes, yes, I'll ask a question, people go, and they're kind of looking like, it's a really hard question you just asked me. But
yeah.
Okay, so first question is, if you could spread a message across the world, one that people would listen to, what would that be?
That you or all of each of us came into this world with our very own unique answers embedded in our soul, and that we need to allow our soul to call us back home through our heart and through our intuition, and just allow that childlike piece of us that most of us lost by the time we're 8 or so, because we've been told to, you know, get real and that's your imagination. And so just take your soul created journey and just let beauty and gratitude and guide you back to your calling and live a life worth dying for.
Wow.
That is my message.
That's one of the most concise and profound answers to that question I think I've ever had in the podcast. You didn't choose this question here, but for some reason I feel drawn to ask you this. Do you have a favorite? Do you have a book? Not necessarily your favorite book, but one you recommend to people the most. Like you need to read this book. Do you have one?
You know, the similar ones that show up on this podcast come up for me. The Alchemist. Mm. I read that when it first came out, and I continue to listen to it and recommend it. And then The Four Agreements, of course, is beautiful. And somebody you had on the podcast, when he said this book, it's like, it is one of my very favorite books, is MODOK, The Greatest Elephant That Ever Lived.
And that was Patrick King.
Oh, my goodness.
Patrick King was his
favorite. Oh, my gosh.
He carries a copy of MODOK with him everywhere he goes and hands him.
I used to keep a copy and I need to get more because it is such a beautiful, beautiful story. Mm. Yeah. There's so many good books out there. It's really hard to, but I love The Alchemist because a good story is good and then it has such a great message.
Right. Have you ever read Ishmael?
I don't know if I have, but I'm going to write that
if
down.
If you don't know if you have, you haven't.
Okay.
It's one of those. And Chrissy McDonald, Mark Rashid's wife, is the one that told me about it. And it's, you know, it's like the Celestine Prophecy or The Alchemist. It's a story, but it will kick you in the backside. Like, as the story goes along, it's like, you got to be kidding me. Oh, you got to be kidding me.
That's my next book.
Yeah, such.
I love that kind of story.
Yeah, no, it's an amazing book.
Yeah.
Okay, next question. What advice would you give to people who are thinking you're entering your occupation? And before you answer that, you kind of have to quantify which of your occupations you're talking about, because, you know, you've got the, you know, you've got the equine therapy thing, but there's a whole lot of other threads that are running through that. You're not like just a horse chiropractor or something like that. So.
No. And I would say this is the same, whether you're going into the equine massage and body work, whether you're going into a energy medicine practice, a shamanic practice, anything in that direction, you want to do the work, you know, learn your history, learn your sciences, your modalities, you do the work and really know. It's the same in horse training. I always think when people, I like this from this one and this, like, learn it well, learn it good. And then you really have something to go off of. And then always ask questions and stay open and don't make assumptions and keep learning and maintain your self-care and your growth. Because the world has what we have to give and we don't all have to look like the other person. But we do need to get the basics down. We need to have the ethics about it. And then from there, we need to just bring in who we are, what our soul is wanting us to share.
Have you ever heard of I think it's a Japanese martial art term called shuhari?
No.
Shuhari is three words, shuhari. And it's basically, I mean, I think Sir Richard Branson said it best. First, you have to learn all the rules. then you can break the rules. And the shoe part is like do exactly what your mentor says, like word for word, learn it inside out and back to front. And then the heart part is where then you can start to branch out and start to pull a bit from here and a bit from there. And the re part is what you're talking about is it's now your soul's purpose, but now you've got all the, you know, you've got all the knowledge, but then you can bring the intuition in and all blend it all together into your own thing. But you can't invent your own thing without, like you said, get all the basics down, like get the basics really, really good first before you try to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah, and then just know that there's going to be another layer to learn and another layer to learn. But, yeah, you can't do it without getting – you don't get to skip step one.
there's a story, a Ray Hunt story about Ray Hunt was doing a clinic years ago, and it was a three-day clinic, and there was this older gentleman watching the clinic. He wasn't in it, was watching it. And at the end of the third day, the old gentleman raises his hand and said, "Hey, Ray, I got a question." He said, "You know, you've been working on some basic stuff here the last 3 days." He said, "You know, me and my horse, we're more like at the intermediate level. So when do you actually leave step one?" And Ray said, "Well, you don't leave step one. You take it with you." And that's what you're talking about there. You can't forget that beginning stuff. You got to learn it, but then you got to take it with you.
Take it with you. I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
So what do you feel your true purpose is in the world?
In the world. This has been a theme in the last couple of years. I've been going down this rabbit hole, and I've been hearing this message as to help raise vibrational frequencies on this planet through my writing, my teaching, speaking, any way I can share media, film. I'm not much very good on social media, so but to share that message and to help come up with ways to raise those vibrational frequencies by working on ourselves in whatever capacity works best for each person. To help heal. I just had the most incredible acupuncture treatment when I was visiting my daughter that she got from one of her bosses, and he works with spirits and stuff. And holy moly, was that awesome. So we always are just working with our, heal ourselves. And what I can, that's what I want to do is help raise the vibrational frequencies on this planet.
Oh, I think you're doing it. So good job there.
Yeah, thanks. And horses are, I feel like I see this image all the time that I'm riding the horse. Like they, I keep thinking, oh, I think that piece is behind me, but they are actually what, they just keep taking me. Mm. And so somehow they just keep blending in. And
very cool. So what quality do you admire in a person?
Yeah, when I first read that, and in my mind, I was thinking all the, you know, authenticity, love, all that. But when I went in deep, the word just popped right out, curiosity. I love that in a human.
Well, don't you, think about when I read out Alberto's biography before, you know, he was the youngest clinical professor at San Francisco State University. He was directing the Biological Self-Regulation Laboratory, okay? But then it says Alberto realized his research had to get bigger instead of smaller, and he was looking at the wrong end of the microscope. So, you know, he was curious about what else is there.
Yeah, it's just anybody who's curious is so open and doesn't leave a lot of room for judgment and all that, because you're just curious about everything. And
did I take a picture of a meme last night? I can't remember. I'm trying to think. I thought I took a picture of a meme sometimes yesterday. Oh,
yeah. It's funny. I do the same thing.
but it had to do. Nope. I don't have it on my phone, but I saw something that had to do with curiosity. And curiosity replaces judgment. You can't be judgmental when you're curious. I can't find it. I must have not taken a picture of it. But
and it's so true, right? You just you can't. And that's what I tell my students on the horses, like, as your hands go on, yes, we know all these things. We know what the anatomy, we know all these things. But when your hands are first approaching, just be curious. Like, if we think we know in our head, it's not going to take us, it's not going to lead us where it needs to go. Like,
And that, yeah. But that is a hard thing to do, though, is be able to let go of that. You know, I read a book recently called Becoming Human, Adventures in 40,000 Years of Consciousness. And it was written by a British, I don't know what he is, maybe he's an anthropologist, maybe he's a naturalist, I can't remember. But him and his son went and lived in the woods in the north of England for quite a while as hunter-gatherers. Like, they're eating hedgehogs and bark and making their own shelters and stuff like that. Anyway, he was talking about the trees, and he said, I've never really seen a tree. As a matter of fact, it's been a long time since I've seen anything. You know, because of my knowledge, when I look at a tree, I don't really see the tree. The light reflects off the tree, goes into my retina, and then I start quantifying, like, what type of tree it is, how long it lives, whether it's deciduous, what diseases it has, what other species that it helps and what species it doesn't help, but I don't really see the tree. He said, I once met a man who could see trees, and it scared me so much, I left the monastery and ran back to Kathmandu and took the first plane home.
Wow.
I once met a man who could see trees, and it scared me. Like, so it's removing all the veils, all the stories, and being able to, and that's what you're talking about working with horses, is you've got to forget, almost forget what you know without forgetting it, or let go of what you go without forgetting it, and allow what's exactly in front of you to come through.
To show up. And I do not call myself an animal communicator, but I get messages, and I always know I'm doing, you know, I'm listening well when I kind of get it. You're full of shit. Like, you know, don't project your opinions on me, because that's not what I'm feeling. And I love that.
When you get those messages, how do you get them? Do you get, is it just a knowing? Is it pictures? Is it?
For me, it comes in all ways, but I know some people have one specific, a feeling, and then you tap into that feeling, and then we can, as we try to process that feeling, we can sometimes come up with some words or a picture. It might just pop a picture. When I'm with the horses, I start to feel the feeling, and then when I tap into the feeling, I can often get words out of it. And it doesn't happen all the time, but I can usually go up and ask, you know, how you doing? Sometimes you get nothing, and sometimes you get chatterboxes. And
I'm sure you do. Okay, next question is, everybody, I love this question. What is your relationship like with fear?
Yeah, the only reason I picked this is because you said everybody does. And so every time I listen to your podcast.
Let's not get into peer pressure here. If you don't want this question, don't answer it.
But it made me, I wanted to say what a cool thing for you to keep saying that, because all through your podcast, every time it takes me down this rabbit hole, like, what is fear? What does that even mean? What is fear for me? I've looked at every dictionary description trying to think on this before we even talked about doing this. And, I mean, obviously for me, I jump toward just what could be a fearful situation, but it never felt like fear to me. And I've realized the thing I've been working on the most, and when I went through like Alberto's class that I was working on, is my fear of disappointing and my fear of not living up to my responsibilities, that kind of thing. That is fear. And I'm really working on that, and I have a ways to go.
The disappointing, is that like a people pleasing kind of fear, or is it disappointing yourself?
Probably more of the people pleasing. And I think that's just still pieces of my growing up that I have to still work through, that So I feel like that's a piece that keeps showing up where I go, are you kidding? I'm still doing that.
But see, that's the self-awareness, isn't it? Like, noticing that you're doing it is like, that's, I mean, you've if, as long as you can keep being aware that it's happening.
Yeah. Then you can keep getting another layer off of it.
And what about the other part that you said? There was the disappointing people. Then there was that. What was the other part you said?
Just not living up to my, what I think or what I've been projected upon my responsibilities. Like I'm always fearful again, probably part of my growing up, that I've just done something that could hurt somebody or that, I didn't provide what I felt like I should have or,
That one almost sounds like a personal responsibility, like holding yourself to a high standard more so than the people pleasing. If I'm reading it correctly.
Yeah, probably. I remember when my daughter was little and I was a single mom, and I would wake up in the middle of the night with my heart just beating, and I was having a period of time where the owls were showing up a lot and hooting outside my window. And in native cultures, that usually signifies somebody's going to die. And I would wake up and I would just say, please, don't take me until I can raise her. Like, don't take me away from her. I don't want to leave her here. And that would just make me panic. And in the end, somebody did die right in front of my house, but it wasn't us. So sadly, I was there for it, but...
And this was right after the owls?
Yeah, it was during the owl thing. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It lived on a straight stretch of road, and this vehicle rolled over the top of a young man, and I laid with him while he died. But, yeah.
Was he a passenger in the vehicle?
He was the passenger. His uncle, I think they'd been fishing, and who knows if uncle fell asleep or what, but it was really sad. It was sad, but those owls, I knew, and I just remember my heart just saying, if it's me, just don't take me away from my little girl while she needs me. Yeah. And that was such a fear. Yeah.
That's pretty powerful. And you have one last question you've chose is, what's your interpretation of leader and follower? What do you think makes a good leader? What do you think makes a good follower?
I think a good leader knows how to be a good follower, because then we understand what that means to be able to lead them. And we must also be always working on self-care and knowing how to guide others through taking care of ourselves. We know how to step out of a situation and look at it from the eagle's point of view from above. And to be a good follower is to be curious and seek to learn and set aside what we think our beliefs are and what we think we know, and to just follow, yet hold true to our values, and not just become a random follower, but to really be curious and open and allow growth.
Wise words, very wise words. Tell us more about the the type of people that come to the School of Applied Integrative Therapy. Do people usually come there with no background in that at all? Probably the question I'm asking here is, there's a way of looking at the world that's not common, and it's usually not people's first stop on their journey. Kind of like with me helping people with horses, usually I'm helping people who've done all sorts of other stuff, and this is the last port of call sort of thing, not the first port of call. Do you have people fresh off the boat, so to speak, or do they usually have quite a bit of experience?
We have all ranges, and enough so much that my assistant developed a little course just to learn about horses, because we would have to send people out to rescues and whatnot just to get some horse experience. So we have those. We have human massage therapists that might not have a lot of horse experience. We have people in the industry that are the top, you know, in whatever field and in performance fields. It's really a range. And I think what draws students to us is that fact that you need to be open. We know we're going to do the science, we're going to do the art, and we're going to allow you to shine through the, I don't want to create just a mimic. I want you to really soul search who you are in this work.
Okay. So that's the equine therapy side of it.
Mm-hmm.
With the other side of it. So I'm reading here, it says you've written a book called The Soul in My Hand. Have you finished that yet?
No, it's not finished. And thank you for asking me on this, because it's going to cause me to really put the, it is a story about a lot of these stories that I'm telling, but also how to tap into that soul piece on your own. The name for it came through a vision, and I never knew what the vision, it was going to be the name of this or that or the other. And so at the moment it stuck with the book, but about, yeah, these stories and how to live your own journey, to journey on and to find your own path and to connect with that soul piece that is you, special you, that what you came into this planet with, and help and how to work through our traumas and so that we can connect that.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, isn't it? I've had it explained to me like, you were born this light, and every little trauma that happened is like laying a thin silk scarf over that light, and it dims it just a little bit. It's not a lot, but this is like little T traumas, you know, and it dims it. But you pile enough of those silk scarves on there, you get to where that light's pretty darn dim, and that light basically is your soul. And how you get programmed to show up in the world that you think is you, because those silk scarves are put on slowly over time. You don't realize they're getting put on. It's almost like you're gaslighting yourself, you know what I mean? And then you get to the point to where you realize the me I thought was me is not me. It's me with all the shit piled on it. And when you start to take a few scarves off and feel different, you're like, how many of these scarves can I take off of here? And who am I when I get to the bottom of that?
Yeah, and how scary! That's a fear thing in a lot of people.
Oh yeah.
In the Alberto's course, the last piece we work on is how to work with death and dying, and how to in the shaman's world, we want to learn how to die our death now so that we can live our life, and all those things that maybe at the end of our life, I wish I would have and I should have said, and all the things and. Let's just do it now and then live our life from here on out.
I don't know if I can get this line right, but you just said something like, in the shaman's world, we want to die our death now so we can live our life. Is that what you said?
Yeah. We do all the pieces that come at the end of life. I mean, and there's energy work that we do with it as well to clear out.
Mm-hmm.
And we, you know, learned how to separate the body from the light body and feel that. But we don't want to come to the end of our life with all these, I wish, and I, you know, I think I told you I was down in Santa Fe at the Reciprocity for the Earth gathering with some of Indigenous grandmothers. It was beautiful. And the person that hosted the this at their beautiful home has been working on a documentary for a very long time, a series they're hoping it will be. And the man said that his father died this just bitter, unhappy, horrible death. And he was curious about that, and he didn't want to do that himself. So he went on this search, putting together this documentary film footage. I think he said they have 500 hours of film. Trying to unwind how to meet death peacefully and feeling like we really lived the life we want to live and that our soul is happy and which is so cool because that's what you're doing here and providing all this information and all this guidance and inspiration to people. So I really appreciate your podcast.
Oh, I appreciate having fascinating people like you on the podcast. I'm just, the only thing I am is curious. Okay. Recently I had someone tell me, they said, oh, you're such a good interviewer or something like that. And this person is always on about accepting compliments. And I said, I don't think I'm a good interviewer. And she kind of argued with me, but you got to accept my compliment. But I wasn't saying I don't think I'm not good at this. But what I was trying to say was I'm not trying to be a good interviewer. I'm trying to be curious. You know
You're
what I mean?
Curious, it's like, you know, I'm not trying.
I'm not trying to achieve an outcome.
Yeah.
I'm not thinking about trying to make an interview good. I'm just curious. And I think if you can do that, the other thing takes care of itself. So, you know, it's.
I agree with that.
You know, it's focus on a process and not the outcome, you know.
At the same time, I mean, you go through a lot to bring this to the world. So I really appreciate that.
You know what? I'd be. This stuff fascinates me, and if I wasn't making a podcast but had a chance to talk to all you amazing people, I'd be doing this on the phone. You know what
anyway,
I mean? Like,
yeah.
I'm not doing this like, oh, we've got to get a podcast out. I'm like, I want to have this conversation. We may as well capture it anyway. You know what I mean? If you and I were sitting down in the same room, I'd be asking you all the same stuff.
Yeah. You know? But thanks for sharing it. It's meant a lot in my world. It's I've just loved it. So thank you.
Oh. Thanks for doing what you're doing in your world. So how do people find out more about what you're up to?
If you're interested in the school, it's www.schoolait.com. And we do have Facebook and Instagram. And you're going to link it below, right? Because I don't remember the name.
I won't, because that's something technical. But my amazing son, Tyler, will do that.
Son will.
Yes.
Yeah. And you really inspired me to hurry up and get on my website because I haven't looked at it in quite a long time. So we're trying to rebuild it quickly. But thesoulinmyhand.com is more the energy medicine piece. And we'll be adding things to that as we go.
Okay. Well, very cool. It's been, you know, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. I knew a little bit about you, and the little bit I did know, I was like, oh, I can't wait to dig into that. And you didn't disappoint me. So it was amazing.
Well, thank you. Yeah, thank you. It was really fun to talk. And again, thanks for keep putting this stuff out there because I look forward to it every week.
Oh, cool.
Or two or whatever. Yeah.
Well, thanks for being a part of it. And for you guys at home, thanks for joining us. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Journey On podcast.
Thanks for being a part of the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick has over 850 full-length training videos on his online video library at videos.warwickschiller.com. Be sure to follow Warwick on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram to see his latest training advice and insights.